and welcome to another episode of Cripple Stomp. I'm sorry I haven't been with you for a while, but we're back and better than ever. So for a couple of episodes, we'll be doing a cost of living crisis theories, specifically focusing on disabled people and disabled people's lives. And in that context, I've got a fantastic guest for you, who's now going to introduce themselves to you. Over to you, guest.
Great. Thanks, Shabazz. So my name's Mark Harrison. I'm a member of Norfolk DPAC, and I've been part of the disability rights movement for the last quarter of a century plus. Previous to the involvement in the podcast, I was chief executive of Norfolk Coalition of Disabled People, which became Equal Lives.
So you mentioned like getting involved a quarter of a century ago. So what made you get involved in the first place? Let's start right at the beginning.
Well, I wasn't born disabled. I became disabled as a child in my late, when I was about 9 or 10, I started having real problems with my legs and my knees. And I had multiple operations before I was 20. And then I struggled to walk properly and engage. And I was doing some work with a colleague called Jackie Christie James. And one day she just said, she's a disabled woman, and she just said, "Oh, come on, Mark, when are you going to accept that you're a disabled person and start using a stick? Because it's painful to watch you trying to be non-disabled and walk without a stick." And so that was a sort of defining moment for me and a liberating moment in that sense. And it took Jackie to say, "Come on, just own up. Say you're a disabled people. Own it and be proud of it." And that was in the early 90s. So, and following that, I got involved. She got me involved in the disability rights movement. The representative organisation at the time was called British Council of Disabled People in the UK. And I joined that. Where I was living at the time didn't have a local disabled people's organisation. I wasn't able to join the DPO right from the word go. But then I moved to a different city and I got involved in local DPO politics as well. But I was also involved, British Council of Disabled People had an international committee, and I was doing lots of work internationally supporting the deinstitutionalization of disabled people's facilities provision in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And we were closing children's homes and residential institutions and creating independent living alternatives in the community. And so I got involved in the international committee and worked on international cooperation with DPOs all over the world.
So that context is very interesting, because it leads me on to the question of, so this must depress the hell out of you to see what's going on now. You know, it doesn't seem like we've moved on that much, or would you say we have?
Well, it's contradictory, I think. You know, the British Council of Disabled People lost its funding from the government and unfortunately didn't survive. And we created the UK DPC, which also didn't survive because the government wouldn't support it. And, you know, the irony was that the government signed and ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of Disabled People, but then refused to support a national organisation to coordinate DPOs, and in many areas of the country, they didn't support local DPOs either. So it was a, you know, it was a challenging time, even in 2007, 2008, when that was going on, and that was a Labour government. And then, of course, the Conservative-led government, the coalition, and then subsequent governments have just really targeted disabled people disproportionately for benefit cuts, cuts to services, and, you know, left disabled people in a terrible state in the UK. That's not the case all over the world. You know, in other areas, disabled people are making strides forward. You know, across the EU, things are progressing. And it's only on this strange little island that we live on, with all the little Englanders and the type of politics that we've got here, that seems to see disabled people as a problem. You know, almost the Tories recast us from the deserving poor to the undeserving poor and the enemy within, you know, a bit like they did with the miners during the miners' strike. You know, we've gone from, you know, in 2012, there was huge, you know, goodwill towards disabled people. The Paralympics in London were a huge success. And then the Tories had to destroy that in order to justify their cuts to our benefits and our living standards and our rights. And so there was a propaganda war through the Daily Mail and the Daily Express and the Sun to recast disabled people as benefit scroungers and then attack us through cuts to benefits. They scrapped DLA, replaced it with PIP, and then they've been eroding PIP ever since. They've cut billions out of local government services. So the services that disabled people rely on to have an independent life or any sort of life have been destroyed by 12 years of austerity. And, you know, the Tories lie because they said austerity has finished. I remember Theresa May probably back in 2017 or 2018 even, I don't know, saying austerity is over, but austerity is a permanent fixture, you know, particularly in local government, because every year millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions are cut out of local authority funding. So it's contradictory. We have a disability rights movement. Reclaiming Our Futures Alliance is strong. When the coalition government first developed austerity and imposed that in 2010, that enabled or out of the anger at that, DPAC was formed, Disabled People Against Cuts, which is, you know, an amazing organization that fights for disabled people's rights and fights every attack on our rights where we can. And there's now, you know, lots of DPAC branches all over the country. You're in Manchester DPAC, I'm in Norfolk DPAC, and, you know, we continue to fight for our rights and fight to defend what we've got and for a better life. So it is contradictory.
Why do you think so many of our fellow citizens buy into the narrative that the government sets?
Well, I'm not sure they do. You know, if you remember back in 2012, after the Tories had been in power in the coalition and we'd had 2 years of austerity, you know, Osborne went to present medals in the swimming arena, and he was booed by the whole stadium, and that was back in 2012. So I don't think people do buy that narrative. You know, it comes from the political class and, you know, the Tory owners of newspapers and the media. It doesn't, you know, I don't think people are fooled, and I think, you know, disabled people get public support, and certainly now, you know, the Tories are hated more than ever. And I don't think there's any appetite for, you know, more cuts to public services, whether that be the health service or adult social care or children's services.
Yeah.
You know, people have had enough. So I don't think people buy into that narrative.
Maybe not, but the reality is that they keep getting voted in one way or the other, you know. So it does make me wonder whether people think, yeah, we don't buy into the narrative, but overall we prefer them, you know. And that's the scary thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's complex. You know, back in 2017, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership in the Labour Party nearly unseated Theresa May.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very close.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that shook the right-wing media moguls and the establishment. Because they could see Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party, Labour government, would change things. Yeah. And it gave them the shock of their lives. So they spent the next 2 years vilifying him, you know, with racial slurs and all sorts, you know, calling him a racist and all this. Every day in the media, you know, he was vilified in order to block a Labour government coming in and stopping the redistribution of wealth from poor people up to rich people. You know, it's a reverse Robin Hood, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. But it did a very effective job, didn't it, if you look at it?
Well, it shows the power of the ruling class in that sense. And, you know, the people, they've got the best conditions to exploit. You know, even during lockdown, their wealth went up, you know, tenfold, a hundredfold. You know, we've created more millionaires and billionaires in this country over the last 5 or 6 years than any other place on the planet. So you can see that rich people and the corporations don't want to give that up. They're becoming, you know, their wealth is obscene compared to ordinary people, and disabled people who are living hand to mouth, can't afford to eat, can't afford to pay their rent, can't afford to heat their house, you know, and children are going hungry. So, you know, it is obscene, but that's the reality. That's where we are.
Yeah. And with that in mind, what do we do as a community, as a group of people to push this particular Labour Party where we need it to be?
Well, I think what we have to, as disabled people, we have to give the lead. We have done for the last 12 years. DPAC is the only group, really, that has fought the last 12 years on every cut and every attack on disabled people. We've had some allies, but not that many.
Yeah.
And the trade unions have been silent up until recently.
Yeah.
Now, thank God the trade unions are finding their voice and flexing their muscle. And that's great. And I think disabled people need to support the trade unions who are taking strike action to defend their rights. And we need to, you know, create common cause and remind them that disabled people have borne the brunt of austerity and have been disproportionately affected. And I think, you know, that's not hard to argue and it's not hard to win support. I think people see that. So I think if we can join our causes together, then, you know, we can't fight this Tory austerity by ourselves as disabled people. We're powerless in that sense, or relatively powerless.
Yeah.
But if we can join together with the organised working class, who are flexing their muscles and taking action, and we can join with them, then I think we stand more chance of fighting austerity and fighting what they're just about to impose on us.
Yeah. And just to say that all the DPACs, as far as I know, are doing all this with next to no budget at all, doing it off fumes, essentially.
Absolutely. But also, we punch above our weight in that sense.
Yeah.
That, you know, without any resources or funding, DPAC is known nationally, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everybody knows Deepak, and yet we don't have any funding, we don't have any paid workers, we don't have, you know, any resources in that set, except our will to fight and our determination. So to give you an example, for instance, Norfolk Deepak is organising a meeting tonight with Unison, the public service union, because Norfolk County Council are planning another £60 million worth of cuts next year to their budget. They've got a £60 million hole in their budget because, as I said before, austerity is permanent in local authorities.
Yeah.
And that means that they're going to target, again, adult social care and children's services because they're the biggest spending department. And they can't save £60 million without targeting us, whether it be for children, disabled children, young people, or adults. And that £60 million is before the budget on Thursday, which is going to impose even more cuts. So we're organising this meeting tonight with the unions, with other community groups, to set up a campaign to challenge that. Now, we don't have any resources, but, you know, we've got a room in a community centre. We've got people who are coming along to join the campaign, and we're going to make our voices heard, and we will try and disrupt their plans. As I say, that's ahead of Thursday's budget, which is going to unleash an almighty load of shite down on our heads. You know, that'll make the £60 million that Norfolk County Council intend to save make it look like chump change, you know. Yeah. But we've got good support from local journalists, and one of them we asked to do a calculation of how much they've cut from the Norfolk County Council budget since 2010, and they've cut £505 million out of the County Council's budget. That's £500 million. Since 2010-11. That's a huge sum of money. But the consequences of that are that disabled people, you know, have lost all their independence. They've lost their well-being. They've lost their ability even to go out and enjoy life. You know, a lot of disabled people now are prisoners in their own homes. So, you know, it's no life at all. So we don't have any choice, I think. We have to fight, and we have to step up that fight. Whether we've got money isn't that important. You know, we can get money. You know, the unions are going to fund this campaign, and we're going to ask them to support it. And what we need, what do we need? You know, we need money for a megaphone, book public meetings, and get people to demonstrations. Well, you know, we can do that on a wing and a prayer. So I don't think money's an obstacle in that sense.
Yeah. And but that's the crucial thing you just said, is that we've got no choice. It's not like, you know, we can choose to do this or not do this. We have to do it. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, but that's how our movement was built. You know, our movement was built on civil disobedience.
Yeah.
Our movement was built on disabled people challenging the state, and sometimes illegally, sometimes, you know, to get arrested. So Disability Action Network, Direct Action Network rather, DAN, you know, took direct action. It was very clear. They chained themselves to buses and trains and taxis, and they stopped the major cities, London, Birmingham, Manchester, and they fought a real battle. You know, out of those fights, civil rights fights, often outside the law, civil disobedience, we were able to make some gains, you know. Transport is still not accessible particularly, but it's more accessible now than it was before Dan started fighting. You know, the built environment, drop curbs and what have you. are a result of disabled people taking action. So disabled people can change the world, but they do need organisations like DPAC and DPOs to organise them, to mobilise them and organise them.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I get exhausted from it all though sometimes. You know, it feels like a constant uphill battle and the hill just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Just when you get somewhere, somebody just adds another bit of the hill and then you've got to climb that and it just feels relentless, you know, and I just want to convey that sense to people that this is an exhausting, we're up for the fight, of course, but it's fucking exhausting, I tell you.
It is exhausting and it is relentless. You're right. We've had 12 years of this shit, you know, so it is relentless. And it drains you. It saps you. Because I don't want to be doing this.
No.
I'd much rather be creating centres for independent living where disabled people can support each other to live independently and live in the community as part of the community.
Yeah.
Be creative, you know, create arts events, you know, with other people, you know, to really create a better world. But, you know, we can't get to that because we're having to fight every cut and every right that they keep on trying to take away. But, you know, I always think about, what Malcolm X said. Malcolm X said, by any means necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know, that's how we have to live. That's how we're being forced to live.
Yeah. We're being pushed into that, really. Well, shoved into it, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, because were you involved in trying to set up the National Care Service as well?
So I'm involved through Reclaiming Our Futures Alliance, which is the alliance of DPOs in England. When the government closed the Independent Living Fund, DPAC led a huge fight to keep it open, to stop the closure.
Yeah.
And that involves civil disobedience. So I was involved in civil disobedience, bringing London to a standstill, blocking Trafalgar Square, invading the House of Commons and trying to get in the chamber, and occupying the grounds of Westminster Abbey. But we lost that fight, and the government closed the Independent Living Fund. But what we did out of that was we organised a national conference to really focus on the future, to create a vision for what we did want, rather than just being defensive and reactive. And we had two national events and two other consultations online. And out of that, we created the vision of the National Independent Living Support Service, NILS. And that's on the ROFA website, rofa.org.uk. And that vision is not just a paper document, but disabled people have made lots of videos that are on the site about what's the difference between social care and independent living. And, you know, it's very powerful. And I know that Manchester DPAC, when they had the van going round Manchester during the Tory party conference, those videos were shown as a way of, you know, showing the world that there is a different way of living and there's a different way of creating disability equality and independent living. So that's an exciting vision. And we keep pushing that wherever we can. Unfortunately, going back to your earlier question about the Labour Party, unfortunately, the current leadership of the Labour Party, isn't engaging with us in any serious way. They're very much about trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again in terms of social care. And, you know, it's like a a sinking ship, isn't it? It's like the Titanic, and they just want to move the deck chairs around, you know, because social care is broken beyond repair. It's never going to, it can't do what it needs to do. You know, it's a privatized for-profit service. 90% of the delivery of social care is in the private sector. The only thing that the local authorities retain is the assessment and care management. And all that is social workers coming round and saying, we're going to reassess you and we're going to cut your budget. So it's traumatic for disabled people. It's not helpful. So that's why it was important that we had a vision, a different alternative to this outdated, outmoded social care system, you know, which is rooted in, quite frankly, a lot of it's rooted in the sort of values and of the 19th century workhouse and 20th century paternalistic dependency creating services. You know, it's outdated and it's outmoded. We need a 21st century solution to the social care crisis. And that is NILS. That is an independent living support service based on the Independent Living Fund. You know, the Independent Living Fund was created by disabled people alongside civil servants and politicians. And it did what it needed to do. And all the disabled people who used it loved it, because many of the workers in the Independent Living Fund who supported people, did the assessments and reassessments, were disabled people themselves using the fund. And it was based on the social model of disability. So it was liberating. And we can create a whole system nationally out of that.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's it.
Sorry, I just wanted to say I was one of them. And yeah, it was run really efficiently. And, you know, it had trustees. And it was a model on how to run a system properly, really, essentially. And the other thing I wanted to say was a little story I wanted to tell you. During the Labour leadership election, I went to one of the hustings, and I don't know if I was lucky or unlucky, but I got the opportunity to have a word with Keir Starmer, and I asked him about social care. And do you know what he said to me? We would like to set up a national care service, but these Tories will make it very difficult for us. That was his answer to me. He was like, well, I had the time. We can't do it because we're not in government and all this. And because I asked him, what is your plan for social care? And he goes, well, we just like to set up a national care service. You know, just fobbing me off, like, kind of thing.
Yeah, so Keir Starmer, before he was leader, did support NILS, you know, but ever since he's become leader of the Labour Party, he's moved further and further to the right. So that, you know, the current thinking, which is being developed by the Fabian Society for Wes Streeting, yeah, is that they're going to reform social care over a 10-year period, over three parliaments. And they aren't, you know, going to reimagine it around the principles in the UN Convention on the Rights of Disabled People, Article 19, on living independently in the community. They're not going to take a rights-based approach. They're not going to take the services back into the not-for-profit sector and create a universal offer along, like the NHS, alongside the NHS. So it's a real problem. We have to keep advocating and fighting for the Labour Party to adopt NILS and to adopt our vision on the basis of nothing about us without us. But they seem to be more concerned with keeping the private sector sweet than they do about listening and working alongside disabled people to co-produce a system that works for us. So that's depressing.
Yeah, and wrapping themselves in the flag.
Well, that's another one.
They just seem to be like we want to just keep the status quo and wrap ourselves in the flag and just hope that everybody votes for us because we're slightly middle managers than the other lot.
Well, it's, you know, it's straight out of the Tony Blair New Labour playbook, isn't it? So
Peter Mandelson's back.
Oh yes, and Alexander, and what's his name, Campbell, Alistair Campbell.
Yeah, you know, even though he's not a Labour Party member anymore, isn't he a Liberal Democrat
now? They're both, their dead hands is all over it.
Yeah.
But going back to the Independent Living Fund, you see, although there were some good things that the Labour government did under Blair and Brown, it was the Labour government that decided to close the Independent Living Fund. It was only when the Tories came in that they confirmed that decision and they carried it out in 2015. But it was the Labour government that decided to close it. And it was the Labour government that brought in privatised benefits assessments, you know, who brought in ATOS to do the work capability assessments. So, you know, their policies towards disabled people were very uneven and some of them were very negative. But there were also some good things. You know, they did push forward with direct payments. They did push forward with self-direction and disabled people having more choice and control in managing their own care. But, you know, it was, as I say, it was very uneven.
But I think it's important that you've just done there to highlight the good and the bad, you know, because it's often people just think of the Labour Party as good, but, you know, because we've got such a shower of shit at the moment, that they just think, oh, well, anything will be slightly bad. Anything will be bad, which is kind of true, but we also have to point out the flaws of the Labour Party. I think that's vitally important. You know?
No, I think, I mean, there's a model from that Blair Brown government. You know, when they came to power, they did employ a disabled person, Jenny Morris, to write Improving the Life Chances of Disabled People. She did sit in the Prime Minister's office, and which oversaw, you know, developments across government and across government departments. And when they were implementing Improving the Life Chances in social care, they developed Putting People First, and one of the goals of Putting People First was to have a disabled people's organization in every local authority area, supported by the local authority and funded by the local authority. So there were some very good things, as well as, you know, some not so good things.
Yeah. And it's important to say that, wasn't it that, you might be able to correct me on this if I'm wrong, but wasn't it the Labour Party who brought private finance into the NHS?
Yeah, in education and NHS. The private finance initiative was that Labour government, yeah. They wanted to keep public spending off the books, out of the government's accounts. So that's why they set up the private finance initiative that funded, you know, lots of new schools and hospitals, but also, you know, the finance deal for the private sector was so sweet, you know, that they have made a killing on it and they continue to and will do for the next 20, 30 years. You know, so the buildings will be falling down, but we'll still be paying for them and giving money to the private sector, you know, billions of pounds over what they cost to build in the first place. But hey.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's very scary. And going back to protest, right? What do you, in terms of protest and the, you know, the crime and sentencing bill, what's your opinion on that in terms of the Labour Party, because he has not been ever stood up against that crime and sentencing bill, you know, and that's really, really depressing, I think. What do you think?
No, absolutely. And it, you know, it shows just how authoritarian and right wing this government is, you know, and the government that brought it in. You know, they are extremists. The Tory party now is an extreme right party. And it's run by xenophobes and, you know, the Nigel Farages of this world think that they've won, because the Tory party is now carrying out their policies. Yeah. So, it, you know, and it's similar to the politics of Trump in America. So it, you know, it's that it is a depressing thing. For me, you know, if I kind of want to ignore that in the sense that I think we're going into interesting times. And the civil disobedience that established our movement in the first place is going to come back. But it won't be just us, it will be others. And, you know, the climate activists are already doing that, which is great. Deepak's been doing it for 12 years and will continue to do that. But if it moves into areas that bring us into conflict with the law and the police, you know, some disabled people will get jailed. But then, you know, if you look at, you know, other movements, you look at the women's liberation movement and, you know, the suffragettes, you know, the suffragettes went to jail, they went on hunger strike, they died for the right to vote. So it's never been easy. And it will be interesting to see how far they're prepared to go. Are they prepared to jail disabled people? What was interesting when Dan were doing the original civil disobedience around transport, it was very hard for the police to arrest disabled people, particularly wheelchair users, because they didn't have any accessible vans and they didn't have any accessible police stations. So they could arrest you, but they couldn't get you to the police station because they didn't have a van to take you in. And when you got there, there were a whole load of steps up to the front door of the police station. And if they got you up those, once they booked you, all the cells were in the basement and they couldn't. So they had to get you down into the basement. So there was nowhere to put disabled people. So it confused them. Okay. Now, the irony of the victories of the disabled people's movement in terms of planning is that all the new police stations, many of them built with the private finance initiative, are now accessible. So we have equal rights to be arrested and locked up in police stations. Hilarious, isn't it?
If you don't laugh, you're going to have to cry, you know? You know, it's just ridiculous. It's like, what the hell? Yeah. And the only is that it just has to be this way.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, this is what I want to impress on people is that this is a political choice, you know. Politics is all about choice, and you just need to make a bit better ones, and it would improve lives dramatically.
Exactly. Well, that's why we need to try and get the Labour Party to have some vision that's shared with us, you know, and just show that we don't have to live this way, that we don't have to, you know, live in permanent austerity and where disabled people can't afford to live, can't get out of their houses, can't live independent lives, you know.
Like I was saying to the Fabian Society or somebody like that, that individual budgets are the way forward, because if you think about it, everybody that's got an individual budget is a small business owner, and we're getting the money directly to give to our carers, pay our carers, and they're spending the money in the economy. It's a win-win, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, in terms of getting, you know, we're now in recession. And, you know, it's just going to downward spiral.
Yeah.
And the budget is going to make that 100 times worse. But if you have a, you know, an investment in the community approach, you know, what we know is if you give disabled people and working class people money, they spend it. You know, they spend it on employing other people, on, you know, doing things. If you give that money to rich people, they don't spend it. They stick it offshore away from the tax man and don't pay taxes on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a different view of how our society can grow, develop, and what have you. The important thing that I think about, and I agree with you about, you know, giving disabled people choice and control over budgets and what have you. I think one of the disadvantages that we have to really work out in the disability rights movement is how we move away from this sort of Thatcherite vision of offloading all the responsibility and the risk onto disabled people as employers, you know, so that we're responsible not for employing, but we have to take all the risk around that in terms of employment law, pensions. And so we do have to be, you know, small business people in that sense. Yeah. And not every disabled person wants to do that.
Yeah.
So we need to find a way of making sure that disabled people have that choice and control and get the peer support. But also we take the risk out of it. The state has to take responsibility,
yeah,
not pass it on to us as individuals.
I think that's a vitally important point you make there. And I'm glad you made it, because, yeah, that's a big one. And the other part, what I wanted to say with, you know, technology moving on and everything, is that sometimes these governments and these organisations think of technologies as the golden ticket. And I always say an independent living should mean that you can use technology if you want to, but you should have the right to employ a human if you want to as well. You know, it should be part of the choice, because often technology gets used as a cost cutting exercise.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and that's the scary thing for me. It's like, and then if you go against technology, they make you out like you're going against progress. But if you just buy into the whole technology argument, you just get left on your own anyway.
Yeah, and that's not independent living. That's not living as part of the community as it outlines in Article 19.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we need the government and the Labour Party to really understand the UN Convention and its articles and implement them with us in co-production.
Yeah.
Because we're the experts about our lives. So it should really be nothing about us without us. Yeah. But also, professionals need to be on tap and not on top, and politicians need to be on tap and not on top, because we don't want non-disabled people deciding things about our lives that they've got no expertise and knowledge about.
Yeah, this is why I wanted to get you on, Mark, because you know what the hell you're talking about, and you've got great lives, like, not on top, you know? That's a great line.
Well, that comes from disabled people in Mexico. That saying, disabled people in Mexico were fed up with, you know, non-disabled Americans coming down from the non-governmental organizations or the charities in America and telling them how they should be living and what they should be doing and organizing things for them, to them, on behalf of them. And they said, enough. We want nothing about us without us, and we want you on tap, not on top. And the important thing about that is that disabled people are in control of the tap, and they can turn it on, but they can also turn it off, and they can tell the non-disabled charity workers and NGOs and social workers to bugger off if they're not helpful. So people need to understand the role of being an ally of disabled people, And we need allies, but we need allies who are respectful and don't just trample all over us and take the lead and take our voice away and our agency.
And you mentioned it a few times about doing stuff with other countries and stuff. Is there any examples you can give us of where things have been done really well? Or one or two other places that we think are kind of weak that we should kind of adopt, if you get what I mean?
Well, I think that a lot of the stuff in Scandinavia and Northern Europe has some interesting lessons in terms of different ways of modelling, of creating co-ops of disabled people and carers, where they work things out together. And I think, you know, there's much more cooperation between government and DPOs in those countries. And, you know, the government's support and fund DPOs, you know, which hasn't happened here in the UK this century. You know, most of the support ended in the last century, in the 1990s. So that's both, you know, Labour governments and Conservative governments. So I think there's, you know, we've learned lessons from, you know, the struggles in the UK to deinstitutionalize our system, to close children, baby homes, children's homes, adult homes, you know, that were run by, you know, the so-called disability charities, the Spastic Society and Leonard Cheshire and, you know, the deaf and blind charities. You know, we've closed those. We closed those institutions, and replaced them with community-based alternatives. Now the Tories are turning that clock back, and they're, you know, reinstitutionalizing disabled people, particularly young disabled people. You know, particularly young disabled people with autism, learning difficulties, young people in mental distress. You know, they're being put back in institutions, which is a step backwards. So, but we, you know, we were able to share our experiences of going forward with disabled people across Europe, in Eastern Europe, and globally, and learn lessons from each other. And, you know, we learned a lot of lessons from the disability movement in America and South Africa and Southern Africa, where with very little resources, they've been able to create very powerful movements and create, you know, big social changes. So I think we are a global movement, and, you know, we learn from each other, and that's exciting.
Yeah. So you don't have one particular country where you could advise me as a disabled person that I should move to if I have the means to do so?
No, I'm afraid it doesn't work that way, Shabazz. Nice try, though.
There we go. I thought you were going to tell me I should go to X and everywhere and everywhere and everything would be fine. I thought.
No, that's fantasy disability.
Yeah. Okay, just to finish up. Is there anything, any misconceptions or anything you would like to say to the non-disabled community that you've got a real bugbear about, you know?
Well, apart from the usual, you know, does he take sugar stuff, you know, don't talk on behalf of disabled people. You know, be a real ally, you know, be respectful, allow disabled people to have their voice, and to create space for disabled people to participate. So I would say, you know, really, we need activists who see the dire situation that many disabled people live in, and to work alongside us to do that. You know, to help us increase our voice and increase our agency. because it's disabled people who are going to change the world. You know, we change the world every day in terms of surviving and creating our own lives. And, you know, that's for disabled people, for many disabled people, a daily struggle, isn't it?
So,
you know, disabled people are fighters, but we need people alongside us who are going to support us and get into the fight alongside us. So that would be my clear message. You know, we need more disabled people's organizations that are run and controlled by disabled people, and they need funding and they need support. You know, we've had lots of reports. I did the research project, you know, about the needs of disabled people's organizations, and the National Lottery agreed to fund the outcomes of that research, and then the funding's just disappeared. So we still don't have any funding, and we haven't received one penny from the British government, not through COVID, not post-COVID, you know, and we're going to call them out. We're going to the United Nations again, and we've produced the shadow report, and we're going to show them that not only is that those grave and systematic violations of our human rights still going on, which the UN found 5 years ago or whatever, and it's still a human catastrophe in the UK. And we've got the evidence, we'll show them. But, you know, they're not, the UN aren't going to come on a white horse and save us. You know, they're not going to charge over the hill.
Oh, I thought they were.
Well, again, I'm sorry to shatter your illusions and
troubles, but... Oh, you're giving me a real lesson today.
They've given us the bullets to fire, and we need to, yeah, you know, to do that. But we need support and resources to help us do that.
Yeah. The one thing I would like to say to the non-disabled community is the thing that really bugs me is they just assume that, oh, the really disabled people will always get looked after. Don't worry. You know, it's the ones on the edges. The government only goes after the people that are not really disabled. You know, that is the one that bugs me the most. Is that, oh, obviously every government will always look after disabled people, proper disabled people, which is complete bollocks. You know?
Well, we know they're killing disabled people.
Yeah,
you know, they're austerity cuts. I mean, that disabled people are dying, waiting for assessments, having been assessed as needing services, they die waiting for services. They're dying now waiting for ambulances to take them to hospital, or in ambulances queuing up outside because there isn't enough space, because the beds are blocked and full up with people who don't have health problems. They just can't find community-based living alternatives because the government's cut social care to such an extent there's no social care provision in the community, and that's what's sending more and more young disabled people into institutions. So young disabled people are being imprisoned against their will, and they're dying in those institutions. You know, if they've got in mental distress, young people are dying in private hospitals, so-called hospitals, you know, for-profit hospitals. You know, young people are dying in those so-called assessment and treatment units, you know. And Winterbourne View, the panorama that exposed the scandal of the ATUs, is over a decade old. And the government then committed to closing those institutions. Well, there's more young disabled people in those institutions today than there was when the Winterbourne View scandal broke. So far from closing the institutions, they've actually carried on. And they're all private sector hospitals. They're all for profit. So the private sector is doing very well, making profits on the backs. And, you know, we've had all the other scandals, the Walton Hall, the Muckamore Hospital, all of those since, and they continue. those three young women who were killed and died in private mental health institutions recently. It came out 2 weeks ago in the media, didn't it? So these are life and death questions. So I know we've had a laugh and it's been great fun talking, but you know, there is a serious underlying problem in this country. You know, yeah, the disabled lives are dispensable and cheap. And that was never the case until recently.
But I also wanted to show that disabled people have got a sense of humour as well, you know?
Absolutely. So I've got a question for you, Shabazz.
Go on.
Do you remember when we first met?
No.
You've got no memory at all?
No.
But you don't remember when I came up to GMCDP, to the Youth Forum, and did a disability equality training course with Audrey, and you were one of the participants?
Was I? I can't remember now.
Yeah, when you were a young disabled person.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you remember that, because I did so many of those things and stuff like that. Right. I had no memory of it. So God makes me feel, I don't know how he makes me feel. I'm surprised you remember that.
Well, once I met you, never forget you.
Yeah, that's what they all say. Yeah, thanks for reminding me about that.
Yeah, no, but GMCDP had a really good youth forum, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was fantastic. And it gave young disabled people a grounding in the social model, in the principles of the movement. And the fact that you're, you know, 15 years on, maybe even 20 years on.
Yeah, I think longer than that, bro.
Yeah, still fighting, that you've come into the movement.
Yeah.
You know, and you're still fighting, I think shows the importance of working with young disabled people and bringing young disabled people into our movement and yeah, into DPOs.
I suppose it's good and bad, isn't it, in the sense that you've still got me doing it, and you know, it still needs doing. So.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, and they couldn't find anybody else to do it. I didn't want to improve my own life and everybody else's life. And I just feel that it really genuinely doesn't have to be this way. And that's the bit that annoys me the most, you know, because that this is the whole choice. And it really, really, I can't stress it enough, it doesn't have to be that way. And you talking about you doing reports and stuff like that, I'm sick of hearing about all the police racism reports. And you know, we've done the two disability surveys in Manchester for the mayor, and you know, there's only so much fucking stuff we can do. We can provide the data, but politicians and policymakers need to do something with that data.
Exactly.
They can't say we don't provide them the data, then when we provide it, that's bad, isn't it?
Well, do something with it then.
Yeah, well, then we won't bother you again with it.
Yeah, words are cheap. Action speak louder.
You're talking to the right person there. All I do is words. Yeah.
Well, we want action, don't we?
Yeah, we need action. Yeah. On a serious note, it's about life and death, really. And this will probably go out after the budget. So, you know, for all that bad stuff you just said, we had no knowledge of it. But, you know, we will carry on fighting. And I think we should bring this recording to a close. But don't go anywhere. I'll talk to you after we've ended.
Right. Thanks, Shabazz. Okay. That's been great.
Would you like to say anything before we end recording?
No, just audience? Keep on fighting.
That's a good message. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Hope you got something out of that anyway. I certainly did. Cheers. Bye.